Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is 9 o'clock on October 2nd, 2023. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. Here today, we have Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Joe Fina, Acting General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager to discuss, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. I'll now turn the meeting over to Mr. Harlow, John Harlow, who will facilitate our discussion.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioners. We've got lots of good stuff on the agenda, so we'll dive right in. First up is Aaron Sweeney with the media update. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Sweeney, PR and Media Liaison. Good to be here today. Talk to you a little bit about what's been going on in the media lately. So we'll start out with the overtime article that came out in mid-September. This was an extensive amount of work that went into this article, a lot of back and forth with the reporter. I thought the reporter did a good job of really digging deep into the details and not just going with, you know, I think a lot of times we get a public records request about salaries and hire earners, things like that, and they just splash a number out there. They don't dig into the details. So I was glad the reporter actually talked with us, went through why our overtime is going up. Why some of the linemen would get more overtime than others, things like that. That was well reported. He actually reached out to Seattle City Light and got their perspective on it, which that was good. A UW professor on the same thing, just kind of backing up why we're seeing so much more overtime in the electric utility business right now. Obviously, storms are a big one, but also building the grid of the future, right? Things like that. So I thought the reporter did overall a good job. Guy Penny did a great job on the interview, and overall, but it was a well done article.
I agree.
Yeah, I was very pleased with the article.
And of course, the leader. I guess they want them to read it.
The headline is always the grabber, right? I think once you get past the headline, hopefully people read the story. I think overall, the story was pretty good.
It had positive comments in social media. My only regret is that they mentioned being an employee. I didn't think that was necessary. We don't get to choose that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, social media comments, which you never see positive ones. Yeah. It seems like nowadays we're almost universally positive, and a letter to the editor that came in a couple days later was glowing.
Was that a retired thing?
I'm not sure. I like to think it was one of our great customers.
Yeah. Well, I saw one negative comment, and then I saw other customers just pounce on that comment.
Came to our defense, added, right?
Wow, when you're in that position.
Yeah, exactly. So overall. A couple weeks ago, we had a meter exchange demo for the media. This was really a chance for them to come out and see what the process is like from a customer's point of view. So they got to meet the customer that we were installing that day. They got to see the installer actually exchange the meter. Got to meet one of our new techs that was just hired recently to lead our deployment. Overall, really good. We got good coverage out of it the next few days. We've got those three stories, and then actually a fourth one came out just a few days ago from the Snohomish Tribune. Overall, really positive coverage, and I thought it was a good chance for them to relay to their readers what they can expect from Connect Up over the next 3 years.
Yeah, I think that they're getting great coverage on Connect Up. Wonderful, no surprises.
Next up, just a little potpourri on a bunch of different stuff that's going on. We've got another story showed up in the Sandwood Camino News on our high voltage transmission line. I just think, you know, we keep talking about that project. I was actually talking to a friend this weekend that lives on Camino Island, and the first thing he mentioned to me was, hey, I heard about that project. You guys did a lot of work for us. So it's getting out there, and I think we're really talking a lot about it, which is great. Just a couple of press releases that we actually comboed up with a few organizations. Utigration put out a press release talking about our successful go live. And then we worked with City of Everett and Department of Ecology, a few others on the helicopter incident up above Spada. So I worked on that, got that press release out. Actually, I have had a few media inquiries about that as well. And then I just threw this in here just because I've been seeing a bunch of kind of news stories about our crews out there. And just, you know, I think we're going into storm season. I think we forget sometimes these guys are working year round. You know, a lot of these things happen overnight. You know, these carpool accidents, those guys are on the spot. They get out there and fix it, and decide to have those in. Publications, Connect Up, I mean, not Connect Up, Current, should be in mailboxes Friday and over the weekend. Customers are getting them. A lot of stuff on Connect Up in Current. Also, a lot of stuff about reliability, outage prep as we're going into storm season, my snowpod reminders, and just a little bit about our community connections. We did stuff on Run for Warmth, and also all the work we're doing for fish and natural resources. And then finally, the fun stuff. We won some awards at the NWPPA NIC conference. We got first place for photography, and our current newsletter, our last fall current newsletter, got first place. And then second place for internal communications and our annual report. Wow. So really that's good stuff.
What is Clark PD? Aren't they usually first?
You know what? Clark only got one award. Yeah. So yeah. I think, you know.
Wait for it to eat.
We crushed them.
So kudos to the team overall, honestly. It's a team effort from everybody on the communications team. They did a great job.
A lot of hard work. Thank you so much.
And I thought I'd finish it off with the photo that won.
Oh, I was going to say the photo.
Great photo. That was from the valve replacement up at Jackson.
Jackson.
And that's not one of our employees. It's one of the, it's actually a contractor, but it's a great photo with all the stuff going on there. So Krista did a great job with the photo.
Yeah, she does a great job.
That's
that
it for me.
Cool.
Got a great smile from the
phone. Yeah. I was obviously paying our contractor's bills for the good piece of money. Sorry.
Well, I actually had, I was up there on the day that Krista took that picture and had a chance to talk to that gentleman. And he has been doing this for a number of years. And that smile is just who he is. I mean, he loved talking about the work, and he travels all over the, mostly the Northwest, but really the country. That's part of what the contractors do. They go to where the work is at the generating plants. But yeah, just a super good guy. Was excited, really appreciated working for us. He said he loves the PUD, loves when we have projects and they can come work for us. So. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and Krista wanted me to add that that's a photo that we won't be able to get for another 40 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Unless this guy didn't do his job.
Yeah. All right, excellent. Thank you, Aaron. So we're going to have Scott Jones come up, our CFO, and give you all an update on the water bond placement that took place in the last week. Morning, Scott.
John, good morning. We would normally come back here in a couple of weeks with kind of a summary. We'll see if we need to do that or not. I wanted to give you a verbal update today just because the news with the government shutdown, and to the extent that that might come up in conversation later, it did have a little bit of an impact on us last week. We went to market for the placement on Thursday, which was 48 or so hours before the shutdown scare. The market was definitely in a little bit of a turmoil spot. We typically, the way this works, and you can do these deals in a lot of different ways, the way we do them is more of a traditional auction function, where we'll go out and we'll bid our various maturities, you know, for the years out into the market at a rate that we think is appropriate based on all the feedback that we get. We did that. We got a little bit of interest, but the rates, even during Thursday, were moving away from us. And so we went back and forth with our banker. We used Barclays. Finally got the deal done a little bit later in the day than we had hoped. But all in all, it was a good placement. This was an $18 million water deal. Placement's a little more than that. You've got some reserve funds and some costs associated with it, but generally about $18 million is what goes into the construction fund. The weighted average interest rates, because each bond placement for each year maturity has its own rate, we're in the low fours roughly. So a lot different than 24 to 36 months ago, still below Still below historical averages, so still pretty happy about that. We needed the money, water needed the money. And so we had a decision point during the day about whether we wanted to wait and come back to the market later, but with all the uncertainty on the government shutdown and what that might do to the markets, we decided to go ahead and move forward. So we ended up landing at rates that were a little bit higher than we wanted, but still pretty good compared to historical rates. So we're pretty happy about that. Very quick shout outs to the legal department that helped us a lot. Colin, his team, Sean, who's not here, but Sean helped us a lot. Brant and his team with Christina and others on the water division, they did a really beautiful job with a lot of the dialogue. We have to have all these meetings with bankers and with rating agencies and everything else for the last 2 months, and they handled it really beautifully, and so I appreciate that. And then I'll give Angela a shout out, who Angela took over for Jim Herling last year, and she's done a beautiful job with that role. Jim is not replaceable, can't recreate 35 or 40 years of municipal bond experience, but Angela's done a really good job. I very intentionally pulled back at times during this deal over the last 2 or 3 months, and Angela just handled everything really well. So anyway, I appreciate Angela doing the job that normally a CFO might do at some point. So she, and then Lauren Way, who's her number two, Lauren, who I think is listening on the phone today, Lauren did a great job. So I'm very, very lucky to have a really, really good team. Those are two of our really great folks on the treasury side that are doing a whole lot of work that I'm not doing. And so shout out for that. But in the end, the placement was fine. We're going to finalize the numbers. We'll normally be coming back to you in a couple of weeks. If we don't see anything that we need to update you on by then, we'll probably pull that off the agenda if we don't need it. But all in all, we're pretty happy with where we've been.
So we have 45 days now to get your scan.
Yeah. Now I right. And I can't, Kim,
I'm going to the bond market.
I don't want to throw Kim out to the wolves here. Kim's been eating and breathing this for the last several days and weeks.
Sure.
And so I don't want to pontificate on all the other stuff that she's watching. I can tell you on the financial side, very specifically to our group, the markets don't like uncertainty. Markets like stability. Markets like predictability. And so you don't need to go to the market, knock on wood, for the next 45 days. In fact, we don't have any plans to go to the market for a while. So for now, we'll cross our fingers and hope that it stabilizes. But the investment side of the house, you know, that uncertainty can sometimes go to your favor and sometimes it can't. So we're trying to play in that space and maximize the investment earnings that we can get. And thankfully, we don't need to go get any more bonds right now.
Well, I'm encouraged as I watch the news that if the people who are representing the House and the Senate are being straightforward, which I'm sure they are, right? Then it looks as if they're not going to have major problems in getting a deal.
Well, let me let Kim, I mean, I have my own thoughts and pontifications on all of that, but Kim's the resident expert, so let me pass it on to Kim. Any more questions on the?
Yeah. I just want to know who the wolves are. Who are the wolves?
The wolves?
Yeah, so you want to turn Kim over to the wolves.
Oh.
Are we the wolves?
Sorry.
Hey, I work for wolves, so watch it.
Fair point. Any more questions on the bond deal? And if not, I'll let Kim jump in on some of the other stuff. Yeah.
Scott.
Definitely don't thank me. They did 99.9% of it. I much appreciate it. Kim, let me hand it over to you.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, that's right.
Commissioners, Kim Johnston, Director of Government Relations. You are correct. The government has averted a shutdown. As of today, they passed a 45-day short-term stopgap bill called a continuing resolution. Clean bill, meaning that it just carries forward fiscal year $23 across the next 45 days. It's a pretty tall order to try and pass 12 appropriations bills and negotiate those between the House and the Senate in a 45-day window. Not saying it's impossible, but I do want to put a dose of reality that that's a hurdle. And carrying forward the dollars from fiscal year 23 didn't actually address any of the debate that was going on some of the sticking points. So all of that debate needs to happen, and they need to pass all 12 bills in a way that works for both chambers. So I think it's a pretty high hurdle. I'll be watching closely. I've watched a whole lot of C-SPAN.
Yeah, me too, watching those hearings.
Yeah, and I will continue to update the leadership team, and I'll be sure that you all see the emails that I send out to the leadership team, just on kind of periodic, where are we at, state of play.
So were there anything that we'd identified where it was going to impact us if you shut down the government or the grants or?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a really hard answer, because a lot of agencies don't put out their guidance on what this really means until the event of a shutdown. I can tell you the things that I'm watching closely. You know, we're still waiting on our grant application that's sitting with the Department of Energy. If a shutdown were to take place, they're not going to be processing and working on those grant applications. There's a lot of speculation on impacts or delays in implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act and the IIJA. I think most important to me, I'm watching very closely what might happen with LIHEAP. That money flows from the federal government to the state. We've been in contact with the State Department of Commerce to see what their plans might be. They're working on firming those up should we see a shutdown. But the timing of that is really poor right in the winter months. There's a lot of social service net programs that would be halted that would really hurt some folks in our community that we serve when you talk about food nutrition programs, LIHEAP. So there are real impacts. And then, as you heard from Scott, you know, direct and indirect economic. I did look, and I think it's fair to say roughly 25% of the state's biennial budget has some federal flow through. So that's a pretty sizable dollar amount.
I am encouraged, just based on the latest news that I heard last night from the House and from the Senate, that the two big issues seem to be there, both kind of on board.
You're likely to hear bit of news this week about the potential of the Speaker of the House McCarthy and his party, a few in his party, trying to strip him of the speakership. I think that's something I'll watch. The real takeaway for us and where we sit in the world is 45 days is already a really tight window. That becomes further distraction to the work that needs to be done. So again, all things I'll keep tabs on.
They just spent 45 days figured out who the speaker's there.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kim.
Exciting times.
Yes, sir. So next up is our residential new construction, energy efficiency and grid harmonization. And Jeff Feinberg is going to introduce our presenters. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Commission and John. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. I'm calling from the lovely and still warm Mississippi Gulf Coast. And so sorry I can't be there in person, but wanted to take a minute and introduce Allison and what she's going to be sharing with you guys today. And so Allison Grinzel is a senior customer and energy services program manager. And I know she's been before the commission before, but I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of her unique role that she's taken on over the last year and kind of what that means for our department before she shares this latest program presentation with you guys. And so like a lot of folks in our department and probably across the district, Allison has had a job title that's not necessarily reflected everything that she does for our team. And so for the last, and you can correct me on this, Allison, if I'm wrong, but about 12 years, she has been an energy management engineer. And so she's been one of our engineers that works primarily with our large commercial and industrial customers on conservation and energy efficiency projects. And, you know, as she's done this all along, Allison has also been really good about always kind of paying attention to other ideas and things that we maybe need to consider adding to our portfolio. And, you know, based on just her acumen and skill at doing that, and as we look at our conservation portfolio and all the lofty goals and challenges we have over the next several years, we really understand that program development and continuing to bring new ideas and new programs to the portfolio is really critical to make sure that we can serve all of our customers and just meet the needs of the district. And so this year we moved Allison from engineering into this idea of kind of program management, where really she's got a lot of things, but it's her job to get to come up and take some of these concepts that our team comes up with or things that we hear about happening in places and take them from being a concept to a pilot to a program to really make sure that we're adding that full complement of what we need to serve our needs into the future. And so I just wanted to do that long preamble to give a little context for what Allison's role is, because we're sharing this program with you today that we're really excited about. But, you know, I suspect over the next, you know, several 6 to 8 months, we're bringing some other really cool things into our portfolio that we want to be able to come and talk with you about. And oftentimes Allison's going to kind of be the mouthpiece because she's doing that heavy lifting from taking what maybe one person on our team shares as an idea and turning it into something that can serve customers. And so with that, unless there's any direct questions for me, I'll turn things over to Allison to share about this cool program.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. What he didn't say is that sometimes I bring new ideas, whether you want to hear them or not. So I'm very happy that we have a management staff that really wants to hear the new ideas. So it's very exciting for me. So today I'm just going to go through this residential new construction program. The expectations for you are just to listen, kind of understand, maybe ask some questions. And the consent agenda for this item will be on the 17th. So there's nothing really you have to do today other than just kind of listen and ask some different thoughts. So the development of this kind of goes back a little bit to 2020. So in 2020, we added the commercial and large multifamily new construction program, Energy Design Assistance, or EDA. You all may remember going to see how we helped out Microsoft. Some of you were able to go to that project. And we had such great success with that program. We had really hoped we'd get, you know, our big kind of like hope was if we get 5 projects in like 2 years, that would be a win. We got 30 projects in 6 months. So really, really excited about that. You know, we kind of have this out in the world saying, oh, our energy codes are so tight, we can't do anymore. Well, that's obviously not the case. So we had such success with the commercial side, we're hoping to get a residential program going. I had some discussions with our Platt group, talked to Ben Davis over in Platt. He was actually on our RFP committee as well. So we issued an RFP for residential new construction. Of course, energy efficiency was part of that, of course. But we also really emphasized some demand response and market transformation ideas. So making those homes basically demand response, time of day, flex energy ready, move-in ready from the beginning. There are not a lot of players in this market. I will just be clear about that. but we were able to partner with a company called Performance Systems Development, or PSD. I try not to use the acronym because it sounds too much like PSE. So, and that would be weird. So they are the premier residential new construction implementer across the United States. They work in the marketing side, they work in optimization. They basically do what EDA does, which is they go out, they talk to the builders before, as the building's being built or before the building is being built. And they say, can you add in energy efficiency? Can you increase that SEER of that heat pump? Can you make it a little bit more efficient? Can you add triple pane windows? Can you add more insulation? Can that roof be a little bit more efficient, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they do the energy efficiency. But we also have this awesome ability to leverage some of these newer technologies, some of these things that can make our buildings a little bit more demand response ready. And since they are nationwide, we get to leverage some of their lessons learned and some of their marketing from other areas. And I'm going to tell you a little story that I think represents that really well. So in Minnesota, they are working with a utility. The utility said, I really want to get cold weather heat pump hot water heaters installed in all the homes you're doing. So they went out, they talked to the builders. Oh, the utility, this is what we do. We put a bonus on it. We're like, we're going to give them an extra $100 or $150 or whatever the bonus was. They went out to the builders. They said, we got this $150 bonus on these cold weather heat pump hot water heaters. Isn't that great? And the builders said, no, don't care. Not doing it. You won't work here? I don't care. Don't want to do it. No, no, no. So they kind of took a little step back. They said, okay, tell me why. Why don't we want to do this? What's the issue? And so they got all this feedback, you know, like, oh, it won't work here. It's not the right thing for our climate. Our customers won't like it. We'll get all these callbacks. This is going to be terrible. It's too complicated. We don't understand it. Blah, blah, blah. They got all those answers. So they listened to all that feedback and they said, okay, hear what you're saying. So then they went out, they talked to the manufacturers of these cold weather heat pump hot water heaters. They got some white papers that showed, oh, this actually works in Saskatchewan, Canada, so we can use them here, right? They also brought the manufacturers out. They showed them some tips and tricks for the best way to install these. They showed them, you know, like maybe in a really cold underground garage, that's not the best place, but you know, in a closet or whatever. So they worked through all of those details, all of the concerns that the builders had, and they went from 86 installed units in 2020 to 108 in 2022. And the thing I think that story really represents about this company is we're going to be able to use those lessons learned they already use. They're going to have all those answers if they get the same kind of pushback here. I also think it's a great representation of one of our own engagement norms, listen to understand. And I really love that about this company. I think it's so easy for us as a utility to put a bonus on something. And then if it doesn't move, our implementers are just like, sorry, it didn't move. Well, they said, sorry, it didn't move. And here's why, and here's how we're going to change it. That's the kind of company I want to work with. Yes.
Good question. On this chart that you're showing, what is the geographic area of that? And is this what that company did, or what does this represent?
So that is the area in Minnesota.
This is, okay.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So
the whole state?
No, it was just Webster utility.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting. Thank you.
Sure. So one of the taglines we're kind of using in energy efficiency these days is energy efficiency plus, meaning it's not just energy efficiency, it's energy efficiency plus demand response. So one of the great things that having a company like this that's going out talking to builders, working with homes before they're being built is, should we decide we wanted to say, hey, we have a time of use rate, let's put a bonus on. If you go on the time of use rate, you'll get a bonus. Or adding things like smart thermostats, or even should we decide that we really want to do this, adding a smart electrical panel that a homeowner can, you know, start, they can jump on a time of use, or they can jump on a flex energy and start really managing their energy. And we can have that move-in ready. So that's one of the great things about this program. And so just to kind of do a little preview of what we have. So on the right, we have our commercial new construction, that's EDA. So that's commercial and large multifamily. And then this new program is going to be the residential and small multifamily. So when I say small multifamily, it's like a 6-unit townhouse complex. that kind of thing. And then you'll see in the middle, there's going to be probably a little bit of overlap. But that's kind of our job to look at that and say, okay, this would fit better over here, it'd fit better over here. And I personally would rather have an overlap than a gap. So that's a little easier to manage.
Allison, I have a quick question about the existing program. So I understand the motivations for commercial customers. I'm curious about the motivations for large multifamily. It seems like the way that market works is they build an apartment complex and they don't pay the utility bills.
Yeah.
But their customers do. So how effective have we been at getting, it seems like such a rich market because there's so much apartment construction everywhere, especially North Carolina, well, everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yes. So how do we get those, have we been successful at signing up some
of
those
yes.
customers, and what's their motivation?
Yeah, so that's the EDA program, our current program. I should have written this down, but I believe that multifamily is about 50% of what we have right now. And there's a couple of paths. So one, this is the one that is most exciting for me, is we have like the Housing Hopes and the low income builders. They want to really get as much energy efficiency in their complex because we know that, or they know that that is going to help with their units' energy efficiency. So that's a big driver for them. But the ones you're kind of referencing, kind of those big builders.
Yeah, they put in electric resistance units.
That's on my list. Anyway, those ones are frankly motivated by the money.
Yeah.
Right. So we kind of bring them in. We say, we want to help you. If you have energy efficiency, we will give you an incentive.
Yeah.
Kind of like what we did with Amazon, right?
Okay. Right.
Do energy efficiency, we'll give you money.
Okay.
So they are motivated.
So at some point that scale tips and it makes sense for them.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the residential side, this is getting a little into the weeds of it, but the incentives actually are going to the builders, which is kind of similar to how it is on the commercial. You know, those incentives go to the owner of the building.
Not thinking their own marketing. Excuse me for
jumping.
Oh, okay. Thinking their own marketing, that would be an appeal for them to rent or. They're selling, they're renting most of these places.
Most of them,
yeah. So, but that would be, I mean, if I were a potential renter, low income, I would want a place that's going to be more efficient.
Absolutely.
So my bills will be lower.
Yes.
So if they, depends on how they market.
Yeah. Yeah. And those, the low income, when they go through the EDA, we go through like literally every single line item of, could you make this more efficient? You know, they look at that, how much is it going to save on their residence bill, and they make a decision. That's a big part of their decision making.
Good.
That's the low income, not so much the ones you like you were talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I see Garrison back there. We stole a slide from his presentation. Just as a reminder, this draft RFP that we stole this slide from. So residential efficiency and also residential demand response is our biggest conservation potential going forward. So we're really, really hoping that this program helps us achieve some of those goals. And again, just next steps. If you have any additional questions, happy to answer those. And this will be on the consent agenda on the 17th.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Yeah, just one more question. So this is for new construction. Where are we at programs for existing construction?
Well, we have our existing programs for existing construction. Jeff may actually be able to answer that one a little bit better than I can. I haven't worked on the,
yeah, right.
on the residential yeah. side.
Right. The heat pump program.
Yeah, yeah. So we still have those. We still have our weatherization, windows.
So if a building is built with a smart panel, I've never heard of a smart panel, but makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Can that work with our connect up meters?
Yes, it can.
So we can potentially give someone an incentive for a certain part of their home.
Yeah, so kind of the thinking, I mean, this is not something we're gonna do day one.
Yeah.
This program, but kind of as we go along and, you know, maybe looking at some of that demand response potential that we want to try to get. So if we decide, say, hey, we want those smart panels installed in all of our new homes, we would incentivize the builder to put them in.
Right.
And then once the customer moves in, you know, they can set up their phone and they can start managing their energy that way.
And just I was just gonna add on to that, and so we do have our existing single family weatherization and heating program, which we have a large, you know, Trade Ally network for that existing construction. But then, you know, what Allison's kind of talking about that we're doing in this new program is really something we're doing kind of across our portfolio, which is we're trying to help kind of future proof all of our programs so that, again, they don't just deliver that energy efficiency opportunity for right here and now savings, but that as we do evolve as a utility and Connect Up comes online, and there's the opportunity for customers to participate in demand response, we want to make sure that just because we launched a program now, when maybe all that is not yet enabled, that those customers still have an opportunity, you know, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, to take part in that so that there can be that enduring benefit for the utility in this investment, right? Where it's not just the EE savings that we're going to get, but it's also going to be the capacity savings that are now available. And that customer, you know, who, especially on the residential side, right? We're probably doing these kind of upgrades in your home maybe once every 10 years, 15, something like that. So for us to make sure that that's going in on the front end, a lot of times it's more affordable at the new construction piece. And we just want to make sure that they have the same opportunities into the future as more of this, these other kind of programs come online. So.
I have a question. So I know that you said this is an outstanding company. It's the biggest, they do a lot of work. But were there other bidders, or is this a sole source contract?
So we did an RFP, so we put it out there. There were 13 companies that looked at this. They were the only one who submitted an RFP. And, you know, if we didn't have to go through the RFP process, this would have been the company I wanted to go with. So I was kind of happy that they submitted the RFP, but.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
Welcome.
Great job.
That's a great project.
Thanks.
Next up is our 2024 poll attachment rates. Felicia and Nate. Good morning, Felicia.
Good morning. My name is Felicia Ng, and I'm a rates analyst in the rates department, and I'm here to talk to you about poll attachment for 2024. Okay. Let's start with the purpose and expectation. The purpose of this presentation is to update the commission on the new poll attachment rate that will go into effect on January 1st of 2024 if approved. So we will be coming back in the next meeting seeking approval, which is on the 17th of October. So let's start with a little bit of background on pole attachment. Currently, the district has about 87,000 pole attachments, of which 27,000 of them are on district poles, and the remaining 60,000 are on county owned poles. So in total, that's about $2 million in revenue each year. And you may remember that last year we approved a 5% rate increase on pole attachment, which came out to be about a $1.41 increase on district poles and 78 cents increase on county owned poles. And you may also remember that the year prior to the last, we actually did not have a rate increase then. So that particular rate increase covered the span of 2 years. But we do review our pole attachment rates every year and have been doing so since 2018. Which may or may not be the case for other utilities around here. As for the rate methodology that we used, we followed the Washington State Code, which was put in place back in 2008. And essentially it takes the average of two methods, the first one being the FCC telecom method, And the second one being the APPA shared cost method. So the FCC telecom rate is a pretty old formula. It has been revised over the years. But the main distinction there is that in the formula, it only considers the usable space of the pole. So if you look at the diagram on the right, that would be the top section of that pole labeled as usable space. And it leaves pole owners responsible for the portion underneath it. So the rate was designed that way to provide subsidies to cable attachments during that time to foster growth. But the APPA shared costs method, on the other hand, recognizes that we need to allocate that common space or that unusable space underneath equally amongst everyone. So that makes a huge difference between the two rates. A couple of assumptions worth noting that we make, particularly at Snohomish, that's different from standards. The first one being the space occupied by the pole attachments. So the standard FCC and APPA assumption use a 1 linear foot per attachment. We at the district have an agreement with our attachers to use only 0.5 linear foot. So that allows for more attachments on the pole, which then helps reduce the attachment rate. The second one is pole size. So the standard FCC and APP assumption is 37.5 feet. We at the district use 45 feet, which is a better representation of what our district average pole size is. And that again helps reduce the attachment rate. The last one is the safety space. So the safety space is that red portion, the sort of section on the pole that's sandwiched between the two blues. So we again have a prior agreement with our attachers to not consider that space as unusable space. So there's that gives us more usable space on the pole. So then again, helps us reduce the attachment rate.
So is the space occupied is a 0.5 foot? Does that mean that customers' wires are only 6 inches apart? A telephone line could be 6 inches from a cable.
In the field, I'm not sure exactly. Okay. I wish Beth was
That's
here,
fine.
But yeah, unfortunately, I can come back with an answer for that.
You mean just the communications?
Well, I'm just trying to understand. We actually have customers, multiple customers on a pole, and they're only 6 inches apart.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was related to my question, which is maybe I was wondering how big are the attachments themselves? Mm-hmm. I have not.
It depends, but typically from your finger size up to probably 1 inch in diameter, just depending on the type of coax or communication cable that you're using.
Thank you.
Okay, so with those in consideration, here are the new rates that we are proposing. It's a similar rate increase as last year. For attachment on district poles, they'll be going from $29.39 to $30.93. And for attachment on joint poles, they'll be going from $16.16 to $17.01. So some of the main reasons for this rate increase is the cost of poles are going up. But the main culprit, I would say, is the maintenance cost. We've seen those costs go up as much as 30%. So it's a big driver there. So in total, the expected annual revenue increase is about $115,000. And we have sent out notification to attachers on July 1st, as we usually do. And we haven't heard of any concerns from our customers so far.
No static.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have a problem raising their rates. The retail rate.
No, they pass it over.
So are the jointly owned rates approximately half because there's a second owner that also gives us that amount?
About, yeah, because okay. We own actually 55% share,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Thanks.
And then here's a look at how we compare against the other utilities around us. A couple of notes I want to make on this chart for our jointly owned rate. There's actually not a lot of comparables out there. So if you were to look at that one, I would compare it to Seattle City Lights one. That's the fourth column on the left. So currently they're at $19.40, and we're proposing a rate of $17. You might also notice that there is a year after each of the utilities' name. That indicates either when they last had a rate review or the last rate that we were able to gather from them. So if you look at our proposed rate for our utility, attachment on our utility on poles, we fall right behind Lewis County PUD and Seattle City Light, which both of them have recently reviewed their rates. So I think those make pretty good comparisons to us.
Maybe more PSD phones?
We're not able to get the rate from them. So the pole attachment rates are not publicly posted. We have to actually seek out and get an answer from our counterparts. So it's a little bit harder to collect survey. Okay, and finally, our next steps, the public hearing on October 17th. And if everything goes well then, these rates will go into effect on January 1st, 2024.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
I like the way you presented it.
Thank you.
Particularly the one on the usage, the space usage. I always found that to be very, very complicated. Thank you.
Thank you, Felicia. And you may notice too, back to the size and how they install those communication cables. Oftentimes you'll see them lashed together.
In a
bundle.
When you get this, I thought.
That makes sense.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, you'll see them. And then the weight, when they do lash them together and bundle them, the weight will start to cause issues.
Yeah. I'm just thinking two separate things, 6 inches apart in a windstorm, wrap around each other. I have no idea. That makes sense. They might lash them together.
All right. Next up is Marine Barnes with actually a couple different items. First one is a surplus and sale of a portion of district property to the city of Stanwood. Good morning, Marine.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Marine Barnes, manager of real estate services. And the purpose of this presentation is to inform the board of the proposed fee sale and slope easement of portions of district property to the city of Stanwood for their extension of Viking Way. Like to outline the primary terms of the transaction, and the easement and deed documents will be brought back to commission for public hearing and approval by resolution at the October 17th, 2023 commission meeting. So the city of Stanwood Viking Way extension, the city is proposing to construct a new roadway to extend the current Viking Way actually between 90th Avenue Northwest and 92nd Avenue Northwest. The road will be constructed with curb, gutter, sidewalks, landscaping, street lighting, and underground utilities. The city's request is that the district convey the following to them. And this is on the south portion of our Stanwood local office located at 9124 271st Street Northwest. So they are looking for 18,094 square feet of land, which we will actually convey, sell to them in fee, 495 feet of a slope easement, and then 2,287 square feet for a temporary construction easement. And right here, you can kind of see this is the office and this is the configuration. And when you see what their slope easement is, really it only goes about 2 to 3 feet linear along there, and that's just because there is definitely a slope leading down to the street. Until recently, this request was not viable, as the property the city was seeking was in use as a pole and storage yard and could not be considered surplus to our needs. The request is now possible, as the district has completed Twin City substations, which now includes a pole and storage yard, and also the upcoming consolidation of our local offices, Stanwood and Arlington, to the North County campus, which will also include additional pole and storage yard. And here's just kind of a view right there of what was stored there. So the Stanwood office encompasses about 1.68 acres or 73,181 square feet. The office at this time, and there is a covered overhang carport area. It encompasses about 8,000 square feet. The city during construction And they also have to come in and do some preloading of materials so that they can get it nicely flattened out. And that's the reason for the temporary construction easement. But the city will continue to keep the yard fenced while construction is in progress. Once the construction has concluded, permanent fencing will be placed, as well as a curb and driveway approach, which was a big one for us. That way it gives us two forms of ingress egress later when we potentially surplus and sell that office. Oh, I already kind of put that up there. So the compensation is as follows. The land that's going to be conveyed in fee, 18,094 square feet, that'll be $217,200. Permanent slope easement, $1,500. Temporary easement, $1,455. And then also to cover some of our costs of relocation, removal of electrical facilities that we had in that back portion of the yard, an additional $26,000, for a total of $247,000. So our next steps are October 17th, 2023, commission will hold a public hearing and vote on the resolution. We ask that you guys at that time declare the property surplus to the current and future needs of the district and authorize myself as manager of real estate services to sign the documents. District staff have reviewed and approved the request. Additionally, and I forgot to put it up here, we did have environmental testing done about 2.5 years ago, and there was just minor contamination, which we remediated. District staff have all looked at this and approved the request. In fact, this has actually been in the works since before I've been here, so it's been going on for a bit. The appraisal was done by a licensed member of the Appraisal Institute, an MAI appraiser. Legal staff has been step in step with us on this transaction, and no equipment, facilities, or access will be impacted. Questions?
No. Yeah, just one question. Mm-hmm. Do you have a feeling for how this will impact the sale value of the office, essentially?
You know, my opinion, this is actually not going to affect it and will probably garner maybe potentially a higher price because of the fact that that property, a lot of it was not real usable and you had a steep slope going back down. With getting this all brought up to grade and the curb cut and the drive approach, it's really going to be perfect. I will go ahead and put out there that we've had some feelers from drive-through restaurants and or banks, which the secondary ingress egress is just going to be invaluable.
I have no questions. It all makes good sense. Thank you.
Thanks.
Want to go right into the next one?
So this is for a lease for temporary storage yard, and I'm still Maureen Barnes from the
I'm Claudia Lazar, warehouse manager.
Here you go. Claudia is going to go ahead and go over. Oh, well, I think I've got the first one. Sorry. So the purpose of the presentation is to inform the board of the proposed 3-year lease with Roger Bell Real Estate Holdings Limited Liability, to outline the primary terms of the lease. And again, the lease will be brought to commission for approval via resolution at the October 17th, 2023 commission meeting. And I'm going to let Claudio jump right in there.
And my slide is in continuation to the supply chain presentation you heard 2 weeks ago. One of our key priorities as a PUD supply chain team is to lessen the impact of supply chain disruption. And part of that strategy is to be proactive in our approach to materials ordering. More materials consequently means more storage space. And few examples, in the upcoming year, we are expecting almost 2,800 transformers, which will double our current inventory. Next year, utility pool inventory, both metal and wood, will increase by 80%. Currently, on average, we need 30 to 40% more space than we needed pre-pandemic. And also, as you heard it 2 weeks ago, our current inventory value is $54 million, which is almost a double than it was in 2019. And although a lot of that can be attributed to increasing materials cost, the reality is that we also increased our inventory, just so we have the parts on hand that we can deploy to jobs across the district. And we all are aware of the current state of parking at the ops center, where we're storing some poles and some switches. So, you know, our hope is that we can free up the parking at some point in the future.
All right. Thanks. So we do have long-term plans to increase the current storage capacity, but this will take some time. Facilities is budgeted for upgrades, which will include adding additional storage within the next 3 years. During the time of planning, permitting, and of course construction, a short-term solution is needed. This culminated in locating an approximate 1+ acre of land. It's 48,000 square feet, which is suitable for our needs at 1480 or 1450 80th Street Southwest in Everett. And it's only a few hundred feet from ops. You can see here's ops and the site, super close. So the lease, the site consists, as I said, of approximately 48,000 square feet. The term will be for 3 years, starting November 1, 2023. Monthly rent will be $6,000 per month with a 3% escalation each year. So year one would be $72,000, year two, $74,160, year three, $76,380. The improvements that are needed will be fencing and gravel at a cost of less than $65,000. No high security items will be stored at this temporary site. And I want to stress that because we're not putting one of the no climb fences up, this will be a 6-foot chain link with the 3 strands of wire at top.
So what would be stored there?
Poles. That'll go, poles I know of.
Yeah, so the team already identified a set of materials that are not high cost and will not attract criminal activity. So we'll have some concrete vaults and other materials that are safe to store there.
So you're saying there'll be no security or?
There will be security.
Oh, I see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, there still will be security patrols, which is really easy because it is so close. So leasing the site, that's what makes it so incredibly appealing is due to its proximity to the operations center, which allows our crews to access it with no additional driving time. The preliminary plan is to store the extra materials up there, and then we can easily go up and still bring them back down to the yard as they're needed. So it's easy access, my goodness, I can't talk, for security patrols. And already we have had it assessed by environmental services and it's fine. The rent and associated costs will be paid through materials management and warehouse.
I mean, security was my concern too. I'm concerned about, it sounds like we're not gonna put things that are gonna be stolen, but you know, tagging,
exactly.
Kind of, but I guess if it's vault is going to go on the ground and it's a pole, we'll paint it or wash it or something.
You know, I don't think that we need to worry too much about it. It will be a nice fence.
Yeah.
These items aren't appealing. It would be very difficult for people to take them away. They don't fit on a cart well. I apologize for that. The other thing is, as our security does patrols, they will be going there. We had Scott Parker come out and look at everything for us. And if needed, we can put up security cameras.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So our next steps, the resolution, lease will be brought to commission for approval by resolution at the October 17th, 2023 commission meeting. And we ask that commission approve the resolution and allow us, myself, to move forward to sign on behalf of the district. Any other questions?
I do.
You do have
Three-year contract term. Is there an option for renewal?
We did not put in an option for renewal. The reason being, we really are planning on moving forward with the new area at Ops, but certainly I can have that added.
Oh, I thought one never knows when you start digging in the ground.
Correct.
What you're going to find. Anyway, I would imagine that you might be able to
I don't think that would be a problem. We've already kind of dealt with the brokers on it, and the terms are favorable. I will say they were asking $10,000 per month, and we were able to negotiate that down to the $6,000.
Yeah, it's a good question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe it needs always like for a while. She's always thinking. It doesn't get us any funds.
No, but it is a really good point, and I'll go ahead and investigate adding that to it, because it's not going to cost us any money to have that potential.
Well, if you can put an escalation not to exceed,
exactly.
As a percent. Anyway, and that isn't a swamp, is it?
No, it is not.
It's on the hill, right?
It's nice and flat, very flat. You've driven by it probably a million times and never really noticed. There's the building out front, and then behind it, they've had this yard.
Okay.
It is currently not fenced, but of course that we know that we get some transient traffic through there, hence the fencing, just to deter.
Is there any environmental risk, or are we going to be storing anything that could cause us down the road to be involved in a problem that property owner might already have?
No, we already had environmental services take a look at it, and we're good. Nothing has actually ever been stored out there. I believe they may have taken some samples or potentially just done a desktop phase one, but it is clean and it's fine. And as far as I know, not putting transformers or anything of that nature, we should have no problems with any sort of contamination. And the leasing agent is certainly not even questioning that.
All I have to add is that I think it's amazing that you found it.
Yes.
Given who the neighbors are and how congested that area is. So kudos.
Thank you. And it was rather ironic how it came about, which was I was looking for overflow parking for safety days. I stumbled onto that, and boy, the rest is history.
Good thinking. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for both reports.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thanks.
Mr. Wolf, can we take a short break before the next presentation?
Okay, would 5 minutes be all right? We could come back at 5. What is it? 10:03. Okay. 10:10. How about 10:10? We'll get 7 minutes. A 7 minute break. Thank you.
Hey, we are back.
We are back. We're now ready for the IRP report, our overview, kind of a preview, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds fair. It'll be an overview, and we'll lay out how this works with the previous briefings, as well as the next steps that are coming up. But before I talk too long, I should introduce myself. So I'm Garrison Marr, the Senior Manager of Power Supply. And you're mainly going to be hearing from Landon Snyder and Chris Scudder, our subject matter experts on the IRP. And we are here to talk about the 2023 IRP overview. So I'll give you our agenda here and walk through the game plan for today. I'll also give you some opening thoughts, maybe something helpful to think about as we're going through these slides. So today we really want to talk about what the study looks like, where we've been in the previous phases. We've heard feedback from the commission that Providing progress reports along the way is helpful to make sure that we're all together and that there's multiple opportunities for feedback. So we're going to go through where we've been. We'll talk about the new elements, which are largely phase four, which are what are the results of portfolio optimization to meet our future needs. And then phase five, which is what could a resource strategy look like that takes into account all of that economic and load service information and provides a path forward. And then we'll talk about the next steps. So today, no big decisions to be made. We are actively listening to the discussion. We do hope that there will be discussion because we are drafting the 2023 IRP update, and we hope to release that 3 weeks from today. And that's a pretty fast turnaround. So we'd love to hear any feedback that you have. And then we'll talk through all the next steps because we want to have an open house, give our customers a chance to ask us questions. We'll come back to the commission. We can do a SEPA process with formal comments once we have a draft IRP. So lots of opportunity for feedback, and that's part of why we're here today. So some headlines before we get really cooking here. First, you're going to hear from Landon and Chris, but this is a big group effort. So we have a couple dozen people in an IRP technical team that do peer review of the inputs, the outputs, the strategies, sort of everything that you're going to see today has been seen by smart people from throughout this, this organization multiple times. We also work with our public. We had an open house to kick off some of this process. And so we're listening to customer feedback too about what should we be thinking about, what sorts of questions do our customers have that we can answer in an IRP. To throw out a disclaimer, you're gonna see some big numbers today. And I don't want us to be freaked out by big numbers, but there are big numbers. So just as a reminder, this organization spends about $1 billion in power supply costs about every 30 months. So we operate in a world of big numbers. This IRP is reflective of that world. And just to put our future load growth in context, if our future load growth was its own entity, not Snohomish PUD, just, you know, utility B out there, that utility B would be one of the biggest electric utilities in the Pacific Northwest. So our future load growth is big, and the numbers reflect that. But our job is not to be afraid of the big numbers. Our job.
My tranquilizers.
Yeah, well, that's perfect. That is perfect.
Because I was really off
on that. So, you know, our job is really to say, this is what we think future load growth looks like. This is what we think it costs to serve that future load growth. We need to have a credible, flexible, affordable, and reliable plan for the future. We have to have it. We have to have it at a time that we are negotiating a contract that today serves 80 to 85% of our load, which means we should not be married to the results of this resource strategy. It is important that one of the things that this resource strategy does the best is stay flexible through that contract negotiation. So what I hope you'll take away from this presentation is that we do have that credible plan. We also have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D, so that when we go through this contract negotiation with BPA for our post-2028 BPA power contract, that we know what the important variables are for us, what we would do under different circumstances, and what we can do now, regardless of how the contract negotiation looks, so that we can take proactive steps for load service and serve our customers. So that's what I hope you walk away with. Our team has done a great job putting that plan together. I hope you ask a lot of questions, and we will do our best to answer those, and we'll have other opportunities too to work in all that feedback. So with that very long preamble, I'd like to hand it off. And you're going to see a little musical chairs today. We're going to be handing off different slides to different subject matter experts. Chris has really been leading our public processes. And Chris will lead us off with what the process looks like.
Okay. Here's it for you. You step down. So we're sort of in continual IRP now. Is this the full-blown IRP, can you remind us, or is this the update to another IRP?
Yeah, so this is the update, and you know, in a typical IRP update, we say, gosh, we just finished one 18 months ago, so we're only going to incorporate the things that have changed in the last 18 months, and usually that's a small amount of things. I'm here to tell you that in the last 18 months, there has been a large amount of things that have changed, and so it really does feel kind of in between a full-blown IRP and an update, but it is the update.
Thanks.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Chris Scudder. I'm in Power Supply, and I'm going to real quickly take us through where we've been and I guess I'm taller than the microphone was. Take us through where we've been and kind of where we're at right now. So these are the five phases that we go through, and we've got a really aggressive timeline here. We need to adopt the 2023 IRP update to the 2021 IRP by December of this year. So we've gone through phase 1, 2, and 3. We've given you presentations on that in January and July respectively. So right now we're going to go through the results of phase 4 and phase 5. This has been a culmination of quite a bit of work on a number of people's calendars, but we want to make sure that you understand you know that we've got a plan to land this thing by December so that we can meet our goals. We're on track, and we've got some results here to go over. So first, I'm going to let Landon do a little bit of scare tactics on you, and then I'll come back in just a second.
All right, greetings, commissioners. John, I'm Landon Snyder. I'm in Power Supply. So in review, this is something we presented our last presentation. So this is our growing load forecast, right? So really quickly in review, we kind of see the three different sectors, right? Residential, commercial, industrial, and EVs. And really the big story there is how the EVs are a significant growth. But still, even still, there was some growth relative to our last IRP in the residential sector as well. And again, that's all caused by electrification, new building codes, everything's all electric. And then, you know, combine that with people buying EVs and some policy in the state that's really driving the EVs as well as from the manufacturers as well. And all that says more load equals more need for resources. So that's the scare tactics. But really, how we do the IRP is we have two metrics, right, that we kind of look for. One of them's kind of down there in that shaded area, that kind of green area is the on-peak energy need at fifth percentile, and then the same capacity need on top of that at the same fifth percentile. So fifth percentile meaning 1 in 20 years. And that's our planning metrics, that's what we plan to, that's what we build for. Energy resources like renewables kind of solve that green shaded area, and then a capacity resource like a battery or a storage project would solve that additional need on top of that green shaded area. And again, this is in review from the last time we did this. And this is after forecast conservation. So we have built in conservation of that kind of low hanging conservation fruit that we're going to go out and get anyway. So this is new resources above and beyond that.
Great graphic.
Yeah. And really quick, I'm going to pass this back over to talk about our resource menu, about how we can solve that growing need.
Yeah. So just full transparency, I'm only going to talk about the supply side resources. I'm not going to touch on demand response or conservation. We've talked about that in the past, and that is in here as well, but they're not in this resource menu. Want to differentiate between the three types of resources that we consider. We have baseload resources, which are generally you're either always on or firmed type of resources. In here, we have renewables plus batteries and biomass, for example, which is generally an always run type thing. We also included here three new options, which are Bonneville above rate period high watermark service or tier two power. We have small modular nuclear reactors. We've placed those as available in the 2030s. And then fusion, local fusion companies here in Everett, we put that out into the 2040s. So we give the IRP the option to pick those up later in the study period. Variable resources, these are your traditional wind, solar plants. We also put in here an option for a run-of-river buyout of an existing hydro project and a customer rooftop solar incentive. And then finally, dispatchable resources. These are your capacity resources or your storage, pumped hydro and battery storage take up a good chunk of here. And then we also did a study on a local run-of-river hydro capacity upgrade. So upgrading our existing hydro with some capacity technology. One thing to point out here is we do put a natural gas peaker in there, and that's for baseline references to CETA. So it's not in our resource plan. It's not available to be selected. It is what we compare against. So this should all be old stuff, but it's fun to talk about some of the new technology that's coming up. So,
so I have a few questions.
Sure.
Do you have any questions on this slide before I speak? Okay.
Oh, no, I'm going to save them up.
I'm afraid I don't want to address it right now.
Sure.
Run of river hydro, that we are on, we have our own. I don't think it's really brought in much in terms of revenue for us. So how are you looking at the potential? Because with some of the river conditions and the future climate impacts, I really question more local run-of-river hydro.
So there's run-of-river hydro local comes up in three different spots here. Right. One is new stream development. So that's your very traditional build a new dam and, or build a new run-of-river plant. The hydro buyout is the new one, and that is buying an existing project. So an existing project somewhere in the area and taking ownership of it. And then the capacity upgrade is changing or adding facilities to our existing projects. All three of these have different costs and different attributes. So these are what's on the menu. It isn't necessarily what is going to get selected.
But, and you're working with other departments to look at the cost ratio, cost benefit ratio.
Yes.
Because I really question the financial benefits of some of these hydro.
Sure. Yeah, we work with our generation department to make sure that we have accurate costing and accurate attributes of our projects.
Okay, and then another question is, if we're going to support the development of these SMRs, SMNRs, small amount, we need to discuss whether we're going to support their development. Because a lot of PUD, not a lot, a few, I don't know exactly how many, maybe 8 or 10 other PUDs are chipping in to help support the development. And when I go to PPC meetings, even PNAC, I get asked, well, when are we going to chip in? So just that's a discussion for another day. But I do think we need to talk about that.
Yep. So small modular reactors, we've assumed our case that they're going to be available in the 2030s, so kind of later out in the study period, and that we would not be an owner, we would be an off-taker of a project that was built. How that gets to that state is not really something that we're worrying too much about in this case. So.
Okay, I guess, you know, we have to decide at some point, do we really support this or not?
Well, Commissioner, I'm also aware of others' interests in Snohomish supporting it, but I also think that for me, a first priority is a value to our customers. And I would put that value to our customers and how it would fit into our load as a first priority, not as to help the public power utilities in Washington State. achieve this, I guess I look more to what's it going to bring to our customers and at what cost.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Jason Duskowski, Assistant General Manager of Facilities, Generation, Power, Rates, and Transmission. In response to your question, Commissioner Wolf, we've been in those same conversations with our peer utilities, and you know they've been asking us, and we've been talking with them. And kind of our response has been we want to work through the IRP process and really evaluate the SMRs within that context. And then, you know, we can decide kind of how we want to move forward at the conclusion of the IRP process. But myself, Garrison, Landon, and Chris have all been keeping up to date on kind of all the goings on in the Northwest. So we're familiar with those, and you know, we'll make those decisions and kind of bring those things.
I'm sure you will. Thank you.
Yeah, you will.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with where we are to be a potential off-taker and not at this time be looking to. Ownership. I'd like to see someone else build first.
Well, I wasn't thinking. I was not thinking that we would be an owner either. But as taking advantage of the energy that will come from that.
And that's it for me. So.
Okay, I do have. So the storage in the first column.
Yeah.
Whose storage are we talking about here? Ours or? The company that provides the solar or the company that provides the wind?
So on the right-hand side under dispatchable resources, all of those would be local resources here in Snohomish County that we would have dispatch control over. If you're thinking of a paired with a variable and, you know, say in Montana or something like that, those are on the left in the solar plus storage and wind plus storage. Those are owned by the developer.
So that answers that question. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. So if phase two identifies our problem statement and phase three is the menu of resources, or at least supply side resources that can help solve that problem statement, then this is phase four and really the result of phase four, which is the result of applying that resource menu to the problem statement and creating the most optimal and cost-effective solution. So think back to that graph previously, phase two, the kind of problem statement of the on-peak energy need. So that's represented by that red kind of squiggly line there. And this is monthly, right? So from 2024 all the way through 2045, looking at every single month at that P5, that fifth probability, or fifth percentile metric, so one in 20 years. So this is, and then the shaded area shows the incremental additions of new resources. So starting kind of from left to right, we look at the light blue column, which is the incremental energy efficiency. So that's above and beyond what we were planning on doing, right? The blue, which will kind of be covered by Garrison, but this is new. This is Bonneville Tier 2. The green is your new supply side resources. So new storage, new variable resources, things like that. And then there's a little bit of a purple there, and that's our demand response and smart rates programs. And this is really the most mathematically optimal solution that our engine could find to solve this metric. Now, in addition to this metric, it also simultaneously solves for this other one called P5 peak week. So this is our capacity need, really. And this metric is a little bit more stringent, but this is a subset. So what does peak week mean? Peak week is a subset kind of, or a more strict version of on-peak energy. It looks at the peak hours in the morning and the evening of the worst week within a month. When I say worst, I mean like the most challenging week to meet load. So this is a kind of a very, very strict metric that's a lot harder to meet. Is generally met with capacity resources on top of those energy resources that we're already building. So it's adding more and more resources to make sure that line stays below new resource stack. So again, all of these are new resources above and beyond planned energy efficiency. So it's a challenge, especially in the tail end, as you can see. You know, we're talking about meeting, you know, 750 peak week average megawatts, if that's a metric you like hearing, it's very challenging, but also very doable, as seen here, where we are able to cost effectively meet that into the future.
It looks like there's a couple places where the red line goes above. Is that just within our tolerance of what we're.
So a better way of putting it is that if we added a resource just to meet that little bit, that you know, call it 25 or whatever megawatts, it's actually less cost effective than just going out to the market and paying a penalty.
Gotcha.
Which there actually is a penalty that we apply within the engine that's above and beyond our market prices to that. So, you know, it's all to say we could go acquire a resource, but that resource is going to cost tens or hundreds of millions versus just paying for 1 month of penalty.
It is the labor.
So, and this gets on to our resource strategy. So kind of from left to right here, we look at we look at the light blue shaded area. That's new. So above and beyond our plan, but new cumulative energy conservation energy efficiency and conservation over time. This isn't new. This is kind of, well, I mean, it's new in that it's above and beyond, but doing energy efficiency isn't a new thing. This is something we've been doing and something we're going to continue doing, right? So this is cost-effective new energy efficiency. The red area shows the short-term market contracts that we would go out and procure just until we can get new resources online.
So is that telling me that we're not going to rely on the market after 2027?
It shows that we're not planning on relying to it. We're trying to be efficient ourselves and kind of control our own destiny and not be reliable on the market, but it's acting as a bridge to get there. So in the last IRP, that same bridge ended. It was a 5-year bridge. It started in 2022 and then it ended in 2027. And this is the same thing. This is saying like, hey, we still need this short-term bridge, but we don't want to rely on it forever. We want to build our own resource portfolio. And the dark blue shaded area, so this is BPA Tier 2 resource. I know this is something that's new to this IRP and also to the PUD in general. We do not historically and do not currently have access to BPA Tier 2 power, but we will. And there's going to be a lot of questions on that, and that's something that Garrison's going to cover in just a few slides here. So we'll come back to that if you have questions, Commissioner. We also want to come back to those yellowish areas, right? And which I will in just a moment here, the fusion and SMRs, which I'm sure are on everyone's mind. Really quickly, let's talk about the brown shaded area. So that's lithium ion batteries specifically. So this was in the last IRP as well, where we're cumulatively adding more and more batteries over time. The scale increases a little bit more in this IRP, last toward the tail end of the period, but in the near term, it's almost the same. So that's kind of good news that kind of a line there that we need to, you know, modularly add a little bit more batteries over time, 25 megawatts here, 25 more megawatts when we need it more, right? And that's the kind of strength that lithium ion batteries have. And then the DRN rates, right? So this is something we're already doing and it's already, you know, starting to roll out, right? And we kind of scale it up. So these are DR smart rates programs. So time of use, critical peak pricing, some technology-based DR as well we scale up in the future. So let's come back to the yellow areas, right? So SMRs and fusion. So you'll notice these are picked up in the last six or so years of the study period. This is because we limited them in scale, but it did find them to be cost effective. So when I say limited in scale, we said there's 50 megawatts available. Now in 2040, who knows how much is actually going to be available, but we didn't want it to like create a plan necessarily that all ends on it. If it finds a cost effective, we want to kind of mitigate that risk, but still allow some exposure. So now, you know, going out in the future, as we do another, 5, 6, 7 IRPs, you know, up to this point, right? We can kind of keep reevaluating to see, well, is it still cost effective? Is it still mature? Is it faster? Is it less? Is it more, right? And this allows us to kind of, you know, again, continually reevaluate, not just those, but really everything in the portfolio plan.
It would be amazing if we got energy for fusion before we get it for new fission.
Well,
that's
so
a year earlier. I like that.
Well, it's, I mean, so we made fusion available starting, I want to say it was 2040.
Yeah.
The fusion companies local to us have plans to do that, 10, 15 years earlier than that? I think 2027, 2028 was some of them. Now, you know, maybe that happens, maybe it doesn't.
Right.
The point is we want to develop a flexible resource strategy that doesn't necessarily rely on fusion being like the savior of all our problems.
Right.
But it still could be a part of our solution. So either way, if fusion develops splendidly and is just like the savior of the world, that's great. We're ready for it. But if it doesn't come at all, we're also ready for it.
So IFRA shows a huge dependence on utility scale renewables. Are we comfortable that we have, that the transmission exists to bring these to us?
So we know we have transmission rights that go down to the Columbia Gorge and into Montana, and let's talk about those, right? you'll see on the left there, so this is the 10-year outlook, kind of looking from 24 to the end of 33. So we have 217 megawatts of wind contracts down in the gorge, the Columbia Gorge, that are expiring over the next 6 or so years. And what the plan effectively says is, hey, that's great, they're expiring, but you need to go out and get some new ones. So, at a scale of 200 megawatts, about the same scale, except these renewables will be the bright, shiny new ones, not the generation one wind from, 15, 20 years ago, right? So, go out, get some bright, shiny renewables, and you can kind of see. So starting in 25, 50 megawatts, maybe another 50 in 27, another 50, kind of add more and more and more. And that's kind of maybe not so oddly in the same way that our contracts are expiring, kind of in the same time frame. So effectively replace those renewables. But in addition to that, scale up your DRN rates, something we plan on doing anyways, so that's great. Bonneville Tier 2, again, Garrison will cover that. And then cumulative energy efficiency. So we always set biennial targets that we reach and see it as far as I'm aware. Our new target looks like it's going to be about 10.54 average megawatts of energy efficiency by 2025.
So are utility renewables, are those baseload or are those?
Combination. So it did pick up a little bit of renewables plus storage and a little bit of standalone. But when we actually go to do due diligence, provided the commission approves this plan,
sure,
we have to obviously figure out what kind of energy profile does the resource have, where is the resource at, all that stuff. So that's the due diligence process.
Right.
The plan just is going to set in motion, like, hey, PUD, go out and do that due diligence and figure this out. With that, if there's any more questions, I'm going to hand this over to Garrison, who's going to talk about Bonneville, all things Bonneville.
Go ahead and move this microphone down 4 or 5 inches here. Great. So Landon laid out, kind of the framework for our resource strategy. There's some new things on there. Tier 2 is one of them. Wanted to make sure we had a shared understanding of what Tier 2 looks like today, what it could look like in the next contract, because it is a foundational near-term action that the PUD could take. So start just with what is Tier 2 BPA power. Today, we get all of our BPA powers is Tier 1 or at-cost power, right? And that's because we're under our contractual ceiling of how much power we can get from BPA. Go into the next contract, experience this load growth that we expect to experience. We anticipate that in year one of that new contract, we will likely above that contractual ceiling, and when you are, you're eligible for Tier 2 power. So Tier 2 power comes in different forms, and we'll talk about those, but it is essentially the power that you're eligible after you've exceeded your Tier 1 at-cost federal power. And the two forms are basically short-term Tier 2 and long-term Tier 2. So short-term Tier 2 comes from the market, which means that it has the carbon that we might associate with the market. It has the price volatility that we might associate with the market. In a BPA context, those rates get set every 2 years based on BPA's expectation of what the market will be, but that's still changing every couple of years, right? So that's the short-term Tier 2. I believe every Tier 2 customer today is a short-term Tier 2 customer. We had very different market prices in many parts of this decade than we've had today, and I think that there will be different types of interest in Tier 2 products given the market prices of today. Which brings us to long-term Tier 2. What's that about? So, long-term Tier 2 is based on physical resources, right? Steel on the ground, named, looked at. It has long-term price stability because it's dollars that went into develop that resource or to have an offtake agreement for that resource. We expect that most of the long-term Tier 2, because it's the easiest to develop in the Pacific Northwest with the most support, would likely be clean physical resources. So we expect it to come with RECs, renewable energy credits. It'd help us with regulatory compliance. So you expect, you know, you'd be paying development prices for long-term Tier 2. They'd be a little bit more stable. You have some regulatory compliance instruments there. And, you know, the trade-off is short-term Tier 2 is going to be priced at whatever that market is, maybe come with some regulatory costs associated with the carbon in that. And so we've got to really think about, well, what do those choices look like for us, and how do we think about Tier 2? That's how. How about why? So there's a couple things going on. One, we talked before about if our future load growth was its own entity, it would be a very big entity. And that means that there's some risk on our end trying to do all of that by ourselves, right? If we're trying to serve all of that, develop all of those resources ourselves, Commissioner Logan, to your point earlier, ensuring that we have transmission rights, all of the physical resources that we will need to develop for that full scale, there could be some risk there. And we know that we're going to be competing with all of the biggest utilities in our state for those resources and those transmission rights. So one way to think about Tier 2 is a planned way to risk mitigate some of our execution risk of getting some of those resources that we may need, essentially saying we'd like to do some of that, and we'd also like BPA to do some of that for us, and finding that optimal balance there. It can also give us some additional optionality. So there's the two different flavors of Tier 2, and we can stagger those in our contract in the way that we prefer, so that we open up an additional Tier 2 option at a given point in time, and we'll talk about what that could look like. But we can use Tier 2 as a tool to provide us more flexibility as a utility. So that's another potentially attractive component. The last is Tier 2 resources come in a unique shape that could be attractive for the diversification of our portfolio. You guys know we have an awful lot of variable renewable resources in our portfolio. Tier 2 comes as flat annual blocks, which means that every hour of the entire year, the Tier 2 allocation is the same in megawatt hour terms. So it's kind of like a baseload resource there. And as we think about portfolio diversity, load service and reliability, it's attractive to have some different types of resources in your portfolio to balance all of those needs and risks. So those are three reasons to look at it. Here is a strategy to approach it, which is, in the next contract, we expect Bonneville will ask us to say, how much long-term Tier 2 are you potentially interested in average megawatts? We're very much in the middle of the post-2028 negotiations, so that could look slightly different, but based on what we've seen in workshops and heard from staff, that's our base level expectation now. So given that, we wanted to make sure that we had a high-level strategy about what that could look like. And so we've looked in this IRP about what would it look like if we set a 200 average megawatt long-term Tier 2 election in the post-2028 contract. Why might you do that? What might that do for you? How does it look? So in this graph, you can see in gray how we would ramp in to accessing a ceiling of 200 average megawatts of long-term Tier 2. And when you do that, you can see that it gives us roughly a decade or about 10 years of runway for some of the really dynamic things that are happening in our market to settle themselves a little bit. So we've talked about transmission access. It takes a long time to develop transmission. We expect that to be a going concern in terms of the challenge there. Market development. It takes a while to develop a market and for that market to settle. We expect that to take a bit. Resource development opportunities, all of those things, right? So a decade gives us some time to look at the world around us while we're doing other things, and then have a designed pivot point, which would occur based on our forecast around 2039, at which point we could say, wow, that market is settled, it's low priced. We're now interested in this short-term tier two, and we'll do some other things for regulatory compliance, or we'll do a combination of short-term tier two and physical resource development. Or that market is freaking me out. We will do the physical resource development and avoid that short-term tier two. All of those options will be available to us at that point. And roughly at the very end of this, we expect that would be about half of our tier two eligibility by the end of the contract term. So it gives us a runway, it gives us optionality, it doesn't put us all in one particular direction, but gives us more tools. That's the rationale for the tier two strategy that you've seen there. And it grows with our load growth, which is pretty economically efficient for us too.
So we've often talked about how our load is growing, everyone's load is pretty much growing, and new resources aren't really being built in the region. Coal plants retiring, those kinds of things. So if a large customer like us starts depending on tier two, I imagine others have increased dependence on tier two. Does this sort of force Bonneville to then go out and acquire new resources? And sure, we've thought about that. Will those be clean resources? What might those resources be? What are your thoughts about?
Yeah. So it's
an enormous question.
Yeah.
Not an enormous number, just an enormous question.
No, it's a terrific question. And at the base level, right? Like Bonneville is statutorily obligated to serve net requirements, right? Whether those net requirements show up as tier one resources or tier two resources. So Bonneville really doesn't have the choice of whether it wants to do this or, you know, whether it thinks it can do this in some respect. It just knows it has to do this. And that's true on both the resource side and the transmission side to deliver those resources. So from just a 30,000 foot level, if I'm at Bonneville right now, I'm planning like I absolutely have to do this. From a physical resource development side, you know, if I'm Bonneville, I'm probably not planning to build a coal plant in 2020 Pacific Northwest. I also don't think it's probably that practical in many Pacific Northwest states to try a natural gas plant. I think de facto, you know, the operating environment that we're in, that puts Bonneville into a mode of developing clean resources for a known net requirement, you know, growth that's heading its direction. And we see that sort of thing in the BPA resource program, where the types of resources that they're identifying are all clean resources. John, it looked like you were.
No, perfect.
So this is sort of some of the foundational pieces for this tier two, right? So I think what this tells us, right, as an organization is we're interested in this. We're interested in the regulatory compliance, the resource diversity aspects of the long-term product. It also gives us some price stability for our customers. And we want to engineer in some flexibility so we have some different places to go over a time period that we expect, you know, just continued rapid change, and want to make sure that we have the opportunity to respond to that change for our customers.
Let me ask another question. This is Bonneville. I mean, it's all the things I've, workshops I've attended on Bonneville, it's still part of it. It's a sort of a mystery. So does more customers taking tier two, does that decrease our available slice for sliced all customers?
Completely different part of the system. Yep. Yeah, yep. So using a pizza analogy, since that's part of my lifestyle, you know, it's not that the pizza gets bigger, it's that there's the tier one pizza and you got a side tier two pizza.
Okay.
Earlier, there was some comment, and I should have written it down. This is tier two, the same as tier one in terms of we have the first bite of the apple.
Tier two is a statutory right.
Okay, it falls under the statute. Okay.
But there is a queue. You know, I saw something in the notes about in tier two, there's a queue. You have to.
So there's some contractual mechanisms for tier two that Bonneville will ask us to make elections on in the course of the post 2028 contract. All the specifics of how they'll structure those asks, you know, we have some high level ideas about, but we don't have all the specifics. So what we're trying to do is take those concepts that have been shared. You may need to elect a volume of long-term tier two, but you always have rights, right, to your full net requirement on an annual basis at tier two. So we're trying to say, well, let's strategize on that first building block. How much tier two might we want to elect of the long-term variety? This is all the rationale and logic for that volume. But something different occurs in this contract negotiation, we will absolutely, you know, adapt and make the best choice.
But it only comes as block.
Yeah. Yeah. So 8760.
The cold days and the warm summer. Yeah.
But the short term tier two has more carbon impacts than the long term. Is that correct?
That's our expectation.
Why is that?
It's sourced from the market. And so when you're buying from the market has a mix of all the things right on the grid. And some of those things aren't as clean as others.
And so to guarantee term two in those packets, I'm just kind of seeing it in little blocks, then they have to accept that to be able to ensure that that's going to be there.
I think, you know, when Bonneville essentially gets its orders from customers for the volume of short-term tier two that they want, then Bonneville goes out and procures that from the market, and they are at the mercy of that market for what's available to them and how much it costs and all those pieces.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this is the, oh yeah, Commissioner Logan.
Good question, Commissioner Wolf, because I guess that's where I'm going. Bonneville knows that it's going to have day to day more tier two, and perhaps they will acquire some clean resources. I mean, I know they still haven't figured out carbon in the new contract, but it just seems like they're going to have to. It seems like a no-brainer. So it, you know, that may drive new resources. It just seems to be.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Clean.
But I think that's where we want Bonneville also to play offense and thinking about the future and the significant increase in load, not just by us, but by the entire region. And, I think that's one of our concerns.
Well, I hope they'll look at our IRP with the closure.
I think we could be an attractive anchor tenant for long-term.
This is Joe Fina, the Gears, and if you just wanted to see a few things. One is that Bonneville has an annual planning, basically report that it does, to figure out what it needs in order to serve its customers. It also, on a, let's call it on a daily basis, manages that. So the more information that they have beforehand, they'll go ahead and put that into their annual plan, and then they'll tweak it, you know, along the way. So it's not going to be a surprise for a lot of them.
So that's tier two. That's an important part of kind of what's in that long-term resource strategy. It's near-term implications because we expect we'll be signing a post-2028 BPA contract in 2025. So it gives us a roadmap there. Another important part about post-2028 is that we'll have an opportunity to select what BPA power product we want. We have the block slice product today. Today, there is also a variety of block products, which is just firm energy. So you could get that flat annual block, which is essentially what tier two is shaped as. You could get block with shaping capacity, which has a lot of constraints on it today. Or you could get the load following product. Majority of EDA's customers do have the load following product, although about 42% of BPA's customers by load have either the block or the block slice product. We have the block slice product. So one of the things that we wanted to do in this IRP, it is analyze from a long-term perspective all the limitations of what we don't know in the BPA post-2028 process today. Would we be better served by continuing with the block slice product or taking a look at the block with shaping capacity or the load following product? I'm here to tell you that we threw the block with shaping capacity idea out the window extremely quickly. It wasn't close, it wasn't competitive, there was too many constraints on that product for load service. BPA is working on that product, but it's not a winner for us if it's in the form today. The load following product is really dependent on what those rates are in the BPA bill as to what that could look like. So we looked at very conservative pricing, full capacity prices, no grandfathered in capacity rights, pricing in RAF compliance costs and distributing them. That's the conservative view. We looked at a moderate pricing, which would be marginal capacity prices, but it would still allow some grandfathered capacity rights in there and not account for RAP compliance costs. And then we looked at today's load following pricing, which is very below market marginal capacity pricing, no RAP compliance cost pass-throughs, and a significant volume of grandfathered capacity rights for those customers. In all of these cases, the block slice solution is a cheaper solution for our customers than the load following product under those different pricing configurations. This is not the final word. Block slice could look worse after we're through this process. Load following could look better. It's possible. A dark horse block with shaping capacity product could come out of nowhere and blow us away. But what we wanted to do was have a sense of what's important to us, what are the variables that are meaningful for cost, and what actions would we take if we had a different product so that when we're looking at the next 2 to 3 years, we're prioritizing those actions that would work terrific for the block slice product and also work terrific for a load following product. We're prioritizing flexibility there. So this is the headline slide, which is block slice. That's still our preferred strategy, unless BPA proves otherwise there. But that means we're also going to advocate really hard for the block slice product because that's our best outcome.
So what does BPA need in order to be able to do the shaping, the load shaping?
So BPA essentially has to reserve a part of their system and make it available for use for customers for load service needs.
But they're not offering that now.
They do. The reason why it's not attractive today is because the amount of capacity available to the block with shaping capacity product is pretty limited, and it can only be used in what's called on-peak hours. On-peak hours, that's just 16 hours a day, or generally 6 days a week. But there's a problem, because we love to serve our customers' loads on Sundays, and that is not an on-peak hour day. So you get no capacity on Sunday or holidays, another day we love to serve our customers' loads. So it's really the constraints that make that a challenge in terms of the load service to us for the cost.
Get your demand response, no football.
I was reminded of that movie, Never on Sunday.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
So, you know, we will absolutely keep an open mind and advocate for smart enhancements to that product. But in its form today, you know, we've been very clear with BPA that it's not a winner. And these are the things that make it not a winner.
Well, thank you, Gareth, and keep doing this analysis. This is really, really helpful.
Does BPA buy a lot of solar from California? Or do you know?
You know, depending on the day and the hour, BPA can be an importer from California, but usually through market mechanisms. They don't have any long-term rights to specific solar resources in California.
And are you getting, in fact, it's probably too early, that through the negotiation process, hearing process, that Lot Slice is going to look any different?
We are hearing through the
Which would, I guess, be negative for us.
Yes, we're hearing some negative things. There's a peak net requirements policy that BPA is contemplating in the draft record of decision for policy in the post-2028 contract. It's possible that policy could limit the capacity of the slice portion of the block slice product. And if that were the case, that would change some of the usability of that product. But BPA has also not been clear about what they mean in the peak net requirements policy, how it would be used, if it's a product application, a rates application, or something different. And so we're working with all of our regional peers, all 42% of the BPA customer base by load surface, to advocate strongly that a smart peak net requirement policy is adopted that does not limit load service that customers like us need. But that's the biggest risk.
It would seem like a lot of them would want slice customers to take some of the risk off them.
Absolutely.
Puts it on us, and that's the surprise.
Yeah. And I'll show you in this next slide a little bit more detail on this analysis. Just want to make sure that we're aware of the variables. I promise. Spend too much time on it, but you'll see that same value proposition potentially from Bonneville's perspective as well. So this is the variables inside the analysis of the slide that you just saw. So the block slice solution, this has both positive and negative values here. So the net is important as you look at this on the y-axis. That's the same outcome, right, as the last slide, block slice solution. And then you're seeing the moderate pricing scenario of the load following solution here. And these are the component parts, right? So if we go block slice, right, we wind up spending more on supply side resources that are not from Bonneville, right, that we would develop or contract for. That, I think, is part of the value proposition to Bonneville. It's a significant amount of non-federal resources that we would be thinking about, all de-risking Bonneville, right? We would have lower, we expect, regulatory compliance costs, because we expect those would be clean energy resources that we would develop and contract for. We would still do tier two, but we would do probably less tier two if we were a block slice customer because of those non-federal resource opportunities. And then we are acquiring for load service needs that are both kind of seasonal in energy nature and capacity there, but they give us an opportunity to remarket those resources into a wholesale market and generate revenue. And so that's a big upside here, which brings down the effective cost of that solution. Right hand side, you see all the component parts of load following, where you wind up with a more expensive BPA product. So that's what that incremental cost is all about. Your supply side resources are really reduced. You're disincentivized from really going out and doing that to the same extent because of the way the billing for the load following product works. So that does get reduced. The regulatory costs go up because bundles not offering a 100% clean load following product, and so we'll need to make up the gap there. And then those remarketing opportunities go away. So at the end of the day, right, we know what's important about the different products, where the dollars, the cost centers really are, how our strategy would evolve if different things change. But in the end, to your point, Commissioner Logan, we take on more responsibility under the Block Slice product, which gives us more opportunity for us and our customers, but it also de-risks Bonneville a little bit, and that's a big part of our policy advocacy.
Did rolled into Slice in the IRP, does it show a benefit? Do we put in a benefit for knowing that we're going to be headed into a more organized market?
No, we didn't.
Sort of status quo.
Yeah. We priced everything at the mid-C price hub, so we didn't have any differentiation of kind of locational marginal price opportunities or things like that. So that's a lot of discussion on tier two and load following analysis, but they're important, and I wanted to make sure the group had good transparency as to what that looked like. That all is in service of developing a flexible resource strategy like we talked about. We want to make sure that the near-term decisions and actions that we could take would work regardless of BPA products so that we remain flexible through this negotiation. So the most important thing that we can do, the first bullet point, right, is actively negotiate a BPA contract for the best value across products. And we're doing that. So we want the best block slice option. We want a real block with shaping capacity option. We want the best version of the load following product that we can get. And then at the end, we'll choose the best option for our customers holistically, using all of the things that we've kind of already developed the model for in the course of this IRP. We also know that there's some no regret things that we can do and that we should be doing, because that load growth is not going away regardless of the contract negotiation cadence. So we know that conservation is going to be a no-brainer for us. Helps in every product. 10.54 is an increased biennial conservation target, which means we're planning to do more, not less, than in the last biennial period. Smart rates rollout. We've talked here August 22nd about time of use and critical peak pricing, residential, commercial, and the cadence that that would look like for the next several years aligned with AMI. That is going to work for us regardless of BPA product and add value for us. We need to do that.
Value over time, that sort of thing we implemented, but you're not going to really see utility scale value.
Why?
I don't know.
We still think at maturity it's probably in the 20 megawatt ballpark, so it's not the single solution, but it's a really cost-effective risk mitigation for us. In a partnership with our customers, it gives them just more options of what their bills look like. So a win-win, you know, community investment too. There's a couple other programs we want to take a look at that we found could be economically advantageous for us in the course of this. So we want to take a look at a couple water heater programs that we've seen be successful in other places and see if they could be cost effective here. And then there's also a program we used to have, interruptible rates program for those with backup generation or backup storage. It could be cost effective for us as well. So we want to look at reviving that program, or 2023 version of that program. We think that could be really great. Tier two we talked about, we think that regardless of product will be part of what our future looks like. So we want to plan on that in this contract negotiation. We need some bridge contracts for the short-term market, because we don't want to go all in, replace all the renewables in 2025 if the BPA contract negotiation puts us in a different product that treats non-federal resources differently. So we need a bridge still. We already executed a good portion of the first year of this bridge, which is great. But we need to...
there's, Sorry.
Yeah. think I can get into the exact specifics, but I can say that we did execute a capacity contract with no dollars out the door for that capacity contract in a new way that we pursued that than we've done before. A really positive thing for our customers. Batteries, still an attractive resource across products, but the price point of a load following product is important for the cost competitiveness of batteries. We think at most of the price points that we would anticipate, batteries would still be a winner. They're a local investment, which is positive, and they help insulate us from some of the risks that we may have in an organized market, in a transmission congested part of the world, given the Cascade markets are on one side and the Puget Sound's on the other side of us, in mitigating what some of our load risk could look like bidding into an organized market. So it could be a really good resource for us. We want to move ahead with the battery that we're negotiating today. So you'll hear in future briefings kind of what that negotiation's looking like. As we get further into it, we still think that that project could be important for us. But looking at these batteries, if we can get them at the right price point, I think regardless of BPA product could still be a winner for us.
Utility scale,
yep.
So with regard to batteries, they're competitive now. It was just sort of amazing to me when you look at all the auto manufacturers that are tooling up their own plants to make more batteries. The world must have a lot more lithium than we knew. Do we expect it to remain through this IRP still competitive? Because we have increased in there quite a bit. Did we put a time factor in that other than just normal inflation?
Yeah, so you're right that the lithium commodity market is pretty volatile in pricing, and we've seen that. We've seen it stabilize more in the last little bit relative to the 2 to 3 years before that, which is a positive thing. And we're still on the learning curve for lithium ion batteries, especially in terms of cost, round trip efficiency, performance, the number of vendors all competing against each other. All of those things we think will put downward pressure on batteries, all things else being equal, with lithium commodity prices being the big variable there. And then the IRA is giving tax credits for storage for the first time as well, which I think also puts downward pressure until probably the mid 2030s when some of those tax credit opportunities start rolling off.
2 points. I remember at one of the presentations at PPC or PNEC that there's a lot of new mining in Nevada for lithium. Second point, I think there also are going to develop new kinds of batteries that are not dependent on lithium, but I don't know much about that. I'm very interested in an update on batteries in general, whenever we can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We can definitely do that. But for all the reasons that we just discussed, batteries, attractive resource for us, but the price point of those batteries is really important. We're price sensitive there, right? So this gives us a good lay of the land of what we should be looking at next. We need to position the PUD to be ready to release renewable RFP as soon as we get the clarity that we're into a BPA product that works well with renewables. So our team can be working on that as part of this sort of resource strategy action plan as well. So this is kind of where we land, thinking about flexibility, thinking about where we're at, thinking about rising to the challenge of the electrification load growth. We're not done though. We want to have an open house with our customers so they have an opportunity to ask questions, meet the team, meet the subject matter experts that would be tasked with leading different parts of that near-term resource strategy. We're writing a physical IRP update document right now. We expect it to be released in a couple of weeks. that'll be available for review and for public comment. We'll come back to the commission and talk about that document after everybody's had a month or so to take a look at it and really digest it. And then we will come back in December seeking to adopt the final version of that IRP document. So we hope that that gives everybody a good amount of time to look at where we're at, provide their perspective, and for us to get to a great landing spot.
So our communications department is going to help us get the word out about November 2nd. I mean, I think a lot of people would be interested in that if they know about it. So
we had a packed house here at our first open house, thanks to the CorpCom team. We've got a communication and marketing plan for the second one. We hope to do it further north at the Clean Energy Center in Arlington, so that that makes it easier for people that live in that part of our service territory, and we're kind of spreading access around. So we're definitely thinking about that.
Where was the first one?
Right here in this room. That is the work that these guys have done over the last several months. Really, really great work that I'm extremely proud of everything they've done.
Yeah.
Really great discussion today. That's all we have for you, unless there's any other questions.
Not a question, just an observation, the work that goes into this. I mean, I'm going to begin to understand that. But, you know, it's core to the utilities future. And that really hits home to me.
I just want to say it's a huge lift. Thank you so much, and this is a great education today. And I'm thrilled that we're working on reducing our dependence on barns in the short term. So really, which we had in the last IRP too, but I really appreciate that. So I know it's a big lift. It's sort of an exciting time in this industry, all these opportunities and challenges.
I can't tell you how much I admire the work that your department does, and in conjunction with other departments. I'm very grateful. Thank you. I'm blown away. Thank you.
Yeah, great job, Harrison, Chris, Landon, and the entire team. There are a lot of different folks that work on this, and again, we are very fortunate to have the team that we have working on. It's really the backbone of not just our spend, but how we serve our customers well into the future. Excellent job. That is it for presentations this morning.
One second. Okay, it is now 11:19 a.m. and the meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Good lunch.